So let's just ask the question then about Bible geography. After all we've talked about, what is Bible geography to you? That's a subjective question, but I'm curious if you want to answer what it has been to you. And I'll offer some objective answers here on the next slide. But anybody want to answer that? I'd like your input. Yes, ma'am. Great. It helps me. Gives me a picture, you know, a visual picture, kind of puts it in context. Yes, anybody else? Puts dirt in Jesus' sandals. Oh, that's good, yes. That's great, yeah. Well, what you made me think of, Randy, is I'm not opposed to NASA. I'm not opposed to flying and landing on the moon and investigating Mars. But where are people going to be baptized and saved from their sins? If we move to Mars, what are we going to have to move there so that we can preach the gospel and see to it that people can obey the gospel? We got to have some water, don't we? So we got to have some portable baptistries or the ability to distill, do something with the air and make water, right? Geographically speaking, then, where did God put His creation and expect us to reign and dwell in harmony? Right on this earth. Again, I'm not opposed to science and NASA. I think it's fascinating. I mean, but, you know, budgetarily speaking, we spend a lot of money, and yet I don't want the Russians or whoever else getting up there and putting something on the moon that's going to blow us away on this side of the earth. But so, I mean, please understand. But the reality is, I'm not going to do too good of a job baptizing somebody on the planet Mars, okay? Right here is where the water is. And by the way, how much water versus land exists on the earth? A lot of water. 70%+ is water. And that's just surface, by the way. We're not even talking about ground or underground aquifers and water that exist and flowing rivers. So, Bible geography. Anybody else before we go to the next slide? Absolutely. One of the things they said, well, I was taught early in studying the Bible analytically, was to do all that you can to put yourself in a first century or a context. Not that you literally can, but try to understand as much as you can about the context when you study the Bible. To draw out meanings, to draw out warranted conclusions that you might not have seen if you only look at it with a 21st century perspective. And that's a pretty good thought. The word then, empathy. Anybody know what the word empathy means? Similar. Empathy has to do with being able to, not literally again, but almost feel the pain of another person. I can empathize with you, okay? Well, in order for us to be able to empathize, perhaps, with the characters of the Bible, this is when studies like Bible geography might help us have a better empathy. Not that we will ever be able to literally understand the crucifixion or the literal suffering of Noah in his day and age and the literal suffering of Lot and so forth, of those that faced Sodom and Gomorrah and such, you know, but to attempt to be empathetic. It might help if we, again, considered such studies like Bible geography. Again, not to diminish any doctrinal absolutes. The problem with a lot of these studies is people get too fascinated with some of the things that aren't doctrinal, and they get on the sidetracked, and they study this thing out, and it's really not relevant to your salvation. At the same time, don't take that position so far, like Brother Roy Deaver used to say, when someone asked him about Greek. The guy had a PhD in Greek, and they said, why do I have to know all that Greek? And he said, because if someone else didn't know it, we couldn't prove the veracity of the scriptures. You know, and he had a good comeback. Someone had to know that. You know, someone needs to know these things. It helps us. So, again, keeping it in perspective is what we've tried to do and will continue to do, as far as I'm concerned. Okay, great answers. Appreciate the insight. So when we talk about Bible geography, I've got an answer here that's objective. Geography comes from two Greek words, geo, which means the of the earth, and grapho, which means to write, and together they mean to write about or describe the earth. Geography. To the ancient Greeks, geography was a scientific method of describing the earth, its lands, and all of its contents and details. Romans, again, I cannot overemphasize the Roman culture, Hellenism, and what they have done to this world. The organization, the mathematical concepts and things that they established have done tremendous things, and we are still reaping the benefits of a lot of their structure. Very detailed. There's a source online where I get a lot of this information. You can go there. I'm not trying to hide any of this. I'm not a genius. This stuff is available in books, and it's available on the internet. And at that website, www.bible-history.com/geography, you can find a lot of this information, the maps and so forth. www.bible-history.com is a website in and of itself. It's very interesting. Now, it's not organized or run by members of the church, but it is, it's very conservative. I found it very interesting. I've used it before this class. So if you're on the computer and you want to continue studying things like this, that website might help you. Continuing, before we look at some final maps and so forth. Biblical geography is the study of Bible lands and an examination of the places and features that are within the boundaries of those lands. Biblical geography is important, as our sister back here just said, because of God is in history, just as Randy said, just as you said, just as we've said. It connects us with the people. It connects us with Jesus. It puts dirt, sand in his sandals. Again, connected to the geography of the land from which the events in history occurred. All the events in the Bible happened in time and happened in a certain place, on a mountain or near a river, on a boat, in a lake, in a valley, or on the seacoast. In fact, the God of history also fashioned geography because God is in control and even, as the Proverbs writer says, the king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. As the rivers of the water, he turns it wherever he wills. Again, God is in an omnipotent position. He is in an omniscient position. And he created this world and he fashioned this world as he designed it. And when we learn about that design and we find ourselves in harmony with that design, in harmony with his will, can see that design, then we can see that will. What problem the atheists have is interesting from that standpoint, because they don't see the design, but they do see the design. The difference between the atheist and you and me is that we see the design, they see a design, but we see the will of God and its design. You have to think about that from a philosophical standpoint. The atheists are aggravated that there is design. But what does the word design imply? There is a great designer. And you and I pick up the Bible and go, wow, there it is. There's the design. There's the pattern. That's exactly right. The atheist has an ego bigger than Texas. You know, they want to be in control. That's right. Very good. So we've talked about Bible geography, but what did we also talk about? We talked about history, didn't we? We talked also about archaeology, and see here, you cannot separate archaeology from the study of Bible geography. This is why it was impossible for me not to pull out geographical, historical, archaeological information, which the word archaeology means what? Anybody know? Archaic, you hear the word archaic, and then the word archaic means ancient. Ology means study of ancient things. Okay? So, that's very simple. Archaeologists have made thorough examinations of the ancient Near East, the Roman Empire, and all the lands in Bible history. There have been absolutely no discrepancies ever discovered, and in fact, many archaeologists stand in awe of the accuracy of the biblical text. Sir Isaac Newton, there are more sure marks of authenticity in the Bible than in any profane history. Now you stop and think about that. Biblically speaking, what book stands the test of time? Here's your ontological evidence. And the word ontology means just, again, subsequential or so evidences that are obvious, common sense, and sometimes we refer to. That's really, in a technical sense, what's called ontology. Ontological argument here. Right there, Sir Isaac Newton made a profane statement himself when he said, not profane as in, you know, profanity, but observant, very simple statement. In the history of mankind, world civilization as we know it, what other book exists that is, from beginning to end, organized, has a true story, historical story, geographical story, archaeological, so forth? What other book is there in the world that compares to this? There isn't one. That in and of itself is evidence for why I'm a Christian. One reason. You ever picked up the Quran, tried to read through it? It's a series of poems and stories and supposed, again, illustrious ideas and such that, here's the question. Could the Quran exist had the Bible itself not existed first? There would be no Quran. The Quran's based upon this, but it perverted this. Your Mormon friends, where did the Book of Mormon come from in concept? In concept and in principle, where did it come from? Yes, but where did his mind get his information? The Bible. There could be no Book of Mormon, there could be no Pearl of Great Price, Doctrines and Covenants, and all the other books that they have, had this book in its entirety not existed first. This is the first cause. And this is what is perverted. And this is what has said from the beginning in Galatians 1. Except an angel, Moroni, or anybody else. Or as Muhammad said, he had a revelation. Preach another gospel than that which we have preached unto you. Let him be accursed. Why? Galatians 1:6-9 says there is no other gospel. This is it. I ask Mormons often, and they've come and they've given me their extracurricular stories. I call it extracurricular. That's what it is, extra stuff, you know. And it's layers upon redemption. And I've asked them this question. You ask them this question. What in this book right here am I lacking that this book doesn't tell me in order for me to be saved? What am I lacking in this book? I've never had a Mormon tell me, well, you just can't be saved without the Bible, or with the Bible alone. I've never had one tell me that. What they tell you is, well, you learn some extra stuff about eternal marriages and getting to marry the woman of your dreams, and she gets to be married to you for eternity. And guess what? In eternity, she gets to have babies for eternity, and that's the essence of heaven for a woman, I guess, having babies all the time. I thought, what a wonderful idea. Hey, honey, guess what? In heaven, you get to procreate with me all the time. Silly, isn't it? But that's the mindset of a Mormon. Why do you think Mormons have so many children? Or try? Because it's extra stars in their crown. It shows their family. It shows their eternal concept in their mind. Again, all perverted from the Bible. Jesus said a long time ago, we are as the angels, neither given in marriage, nor do marriages happen. I guess Gina will be just like an angel. And that's wonderful. So again, you can think about that. We talk about Bible geography. We've talked about maps of the Bible times. This is a map of the New Testament. During the New Testament era, if you'll notice on this particular map, Judea under Roman procurators and so forth, as was organized. Remember, the Romans studied geography. They had their maps and they had their boundaries well defined. Again, over here, the Tetrarchy of Herod Antipas, a son of Herod the Great. Up here, Tetrarchy of Herod Antipas again. He was up here. This was the area where Jesus was from. This is the Tetrarchy of Philip, another one of the people connected to Herod the Great. And I don't remember if he was a son or half-son or how that works. A lot of the lands that you'll read about are, again, still in existence during Bible times. Jericho right here. Again, though Jericho was a telltale sign of Jericho still existed from the ancient days, the locations here on the map were well known during that day and age. I want to kind of point out some things when we talk about the Syrophoenician woman and so forth. That was up here up north, having to do with what is now even today known as Syria up here. I'm going to show you another map here in just a moment. I want you to know some of the names of locations. Tiberias. This is named after a Caesar, in honor of a Caesar. This, again, all represents what was the promised land during the Old Testament days, but by the time of the New Testament, a lot of these names started picking up more of a Roman culture. The influence of Hellenism had taken on its way. You remember the Catholics are real big on this Walk of Emmaus. You've heard of the Walk of Emmaus? Well, again here, Emmaus right here, Jerusalem right here, proximity, referring to again the walk of Jesus on his way to Jerusalem. Again, it'd be interesting, I suppose, to go over to Jerusalem and this land and see some of these landmarks, but I want to remind you, not discourage you, but remind you, as you've said, you've picked up on pictures and concepts by studying this, by looking at this in detail. That's great, because that's exactly what the Bible teaches. And what I'm saying is you don't have to go to Jerusalem to be saved, physically. Literally, you want to go and you can afford to go, then by all means go. But you've told me tonight that by this study alone, you've been able to paint pictures of faith in your mind. And the Bible teaches, God teaches us this, His Word. Faith cometh by hearing. Paul said, whereby when ye read, ye may understand. How many people, how many Christians sit down and read and study all the wonderful things in the Bible to gain as much understanding as they can? That's what the Bible teaches. That's what God teaches. You've told me tonight that that's worked for you. I didn't have to put on the screen images of Hollywood figures dressed like a so-called Jesus in the 20th century or 21st century. I didn't have to make up scenes of, again, a dramatic fashion. I simply, what we did was point out literal, objective things. In fact, I don't know that except for the Garden of Eden in this presentation, going back, that I put a few screenshots or pictures on the screen of a man-made concept. Most of it, if I remember, has been archaeological finds, carvings, things that existed to show you what it might have looked like then. Okay? I just think that that's interesting because Jesus, when confronting the Pharisees, Sadducees, the scribes, the Jews of his day, when he confronted them, one of the questions he asked them often was how do you read? A probing question. How do you read? For what purpose do you read? Think about it. I can take the Bible and read it with a bad motive and walk away with whatever conclusion perhaps I want it to make. So Jesus asked the question, how do you read? And in return, they often would give some snarky answer again because they didn't want to give the truth, even though they knew that he was challenging them, showing how dishonest people are. And that's where the statement comes from, hearing they hear not, seeing they see not. And that statement is a statement which means they choose not to hear and they choose not to see. Don't forget that. People are not that ignorant. I told a man that was in his 60s, he came and griped me out one day because he was just mad. He came in the office and started chewing me up down to one side because I had preached something he just didn't like. And I looked at him and I said, Mr. So-and-so, I'm not going to treat you like a child like you're acting right now. You're an adult. And I'm going to talk to you like an adult because I believe you are intelligent. He stood there like, well, I am intelligent. Well, quit talking to me like this. Let's talk about this. How do you read? How do you hear now? And so we have to consider that. At the same time, I was told never underestimate the ignorance of people, too. It might jump up and bite you like a snake. So, you know, it's kind of like playing again, why is the serpent harmless as a dove type thing. You don't always know perfectly. But nonetheless, again, just consider some of the lessons we have pointed out. A little delayed here. I want to point this out here as we, I might actually go to this screen and then shrink it back. This kind of cuts out over here, the promised land, which would be over in this area. But I want to stretch out and show you. Someone want to look at their Bible at Acts chapter 1, verse 8. We studied this in the quarter on the study of Acts. And in Acts chapter 1, verse 8, that's basically an outline of the book of Acts. That passage, if you follow out what he says in Acts 1, verse 8. Someone get that, if you're loud enough or can read that. That's screaming. Just read Acts 1, verse 8. Because I want to emphasize it if you'll read it for me. I'm going to let whoever gets it go first.
But you shall receive power when the Holy Spirit.
That's fine right there. Okay, Judea, Jerusalem, southern kingdom, Judea, Samaria going north, and it starts to spread. This is, of course, Italy. This is Rome up in here. Athens is over here, right about there, I believe. This is the old ancient Greece. Greece. Not like the movie, but, you know, like as in the nation. The Thessalonica, the epistles of Thessalonica, the epistles to Macedonia, the Macedonian call. Right here is Macedonia, right in this area. You got Asia right here. Let me back up now. I'm going to shrink this just a little bit. The seven churches in Asia Minor. You get to the book of Revelation. And Paul, or the Apostle John, receiving a revelation, has seven messages. And it goes out to these seven churches of Asia Minor. They're pretty closely, you know, close. Anybody know what this land is today? What this is right here? Modern day. That's correct. You know, you can still get in there and go see some of these old ancient locations. But Pisidia, remember Pisidia? There is in Acts 13, Antioch of Pisidia. Paul preaches. Now, here's the point I want you to get. He's over here in Pisidia, and I don't see Antioch listed. There it is. No, that's Antioch of Syria right there. This is where in Acts 11, verse 26, the word Christian is first revealed in Scripture. They were first called Christians where? Antioch of Syria. This, by the way, becomes a very chief location where the Apostle Paul and Barnabas work and will... on their missionary journeys, we'll leave from here. Antioch of Pisidia is up here. It's not listed on this map. I think if I go back, I can't trace. Okay. Antioch of Pisidia, that's kind of a weird word to me. I feel like I got a lisp when I say that. is it was over here somewhere, okay? And over here, Antioch of Syria, Christians are first, or they're called Christians first. After the Gentiles, remember Acts chapter 10, the conversion of Cornelius and his household? The name Christian isn't given in the city of Jerusalem. Now, that's a geography issue in my mind. Now, the Bible doesn't tell us why God did or didn't use the name Christian in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost. Acts chapter 2. They were called disciples, or the word disciple is used. But you get to Acts chapter 11, 11 chapters, or 10 chapters after the day of Pentecost. Church has been established around Jerusalem area, be over here. But it's going to be right over here where the name Christian is given. Now, Isaiah refers to a new name in Isaiah 61. And we presume, I think we have a logical reason to imply that that's referring to an inclusive name that it would include Gentiles and Jews, and that name becomes Christian. It's used three times in the New Testament, Acts 22, and 1 Peter chapter 4. And it's referring to the people. They were called Christians. But it starts right there. My question to you is just for Bible study's sake and for geography reason. Perhaps, why did the name Christian begin here and not down here? Just it's an opinion question, so you're not wrong if you're wrong. That is absolutely correct. We know that after the Gentiles, Cornelius' household, Joppa and so forth, you remember Peter was up at Joppa and he preaches to the, it's right over here by the way, he preaches to Cornelius' household, they obey the gospel, the Gentiles become Christians. Well, disciples. Christ followers, followers of Christ, Christian. And right here is where Paul and Barnabas are more or less headquartered. And we are told by Luke, the inspired writer, that they are first called Christians in Antioch of Syria. Now my judgment, doesn't cost you anything, is that if Jerusalem was the center of the temple, there's too much Jewish pride there. And the Bible records for us that God started calling people Christians up in here. Now you can think about that. I think that's a geography lesson. Now here's another one though to consider. In Acts 13, back over here around Pisidia, there's another Antioch. Antioch of Pisidia. And Paul and Barnabas are preaching and Paul preaches a great sermon in Acts 13. He starts with, again, I believe, Moses, and he goes all the way through Abraham, and he gets to Christ and the resurrection and so forth. And it's over here that the Jews, what are they doing over here? I thought the promised land was down here. This, again, another geography lesson for us to consider. There were Jews spread all over the world. How many Jews had returned to their promised native land that they were given after the captivity of the Babylonians? How many of them? You have to go read Ezra and Nehemiah to get an idea. Second Chronicles. First Chronicles. But what we know is not all of them did return. Now what we do know they would do is for their annual Levitical, the book of Exodus, Levitical, feast days, like Feast of Tabernacles or Booths, the Feast of Pentecost or the 50th day, and the Feast of Passover. Those Mosaic laws, those feasts, they had to return back and they would trek down to Jerusalem for that. Geographically speaking, on the day of Pentecost, Acts chapter 2, when the church is established, what does the Bible say about all the different people there? Dwellers of Mesopotamia? Where's that? Well, that's way over here. They're still over in the Fertile Crescent area. They never did come out of captivity. Elamites, I had to memorize that chapter. Anyway, and then the apostles, by the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, the gift of the Spirit, begin to preach and speak in their own language the wonderful works of God. Well, why were they all from over the world? It shows you in a first century context that the Jews, how united were they? Another question here to consider. How many of the Jews in the first century during Jesus' day, dwellers of the Elamites and so on and so forth, how many of them were cultured by Hellenism and liked Hellenism a little bit? Liked what the Romans were doing? Someone says, now wait a second, Brian. Where do you get that? Let me give you two characters in the Bible. New Testament characters. Who was the Apostle Paul? Saul of Tarsus, very good. Right there, right? Okay, go ahead. But he was of the tribe, but he was also a Roman citizen. He had been influenced by what? And someone says, now how do you know that? Well, I know that because whenever he's being persecuted in the book of Acts, he's got something in the back pocket here. He's hanging on to a card. We saw that's in poker, right? Oh, sure. He pulls out that card and says after he'd had enough and he says, I appeal to... How could he do that? He was enjoying some Roman... That's right. They were like, is he really? They'd already beat him, hadn't they? That was illegal because that guy knew he was in trouble. That's a good point. But another interesting story in the New Testament. What about Timothy? 1st, 2nd Timothy. Timothy, a great disciple, goes to Ephesus, preaches, has some perhaps stomach issues, health issues, stress issues. Let no man despise thy youth, Timothy. Be thou an example of the believers and so forth. Why, Timothy? Because Timothy was struggling. But you remember what Timothy went through that Titus would not go through? Who was Titus? Timothy had Roman lineage too, connections. And he hadn't been circumcised. But he was also a Jew, Eunice and Lois, his mom and grandma. He didn't have to be under the New Testament, did he? But he submitted to it so that he could go and preach to Jews without being a stumbling block. He made a choice to do that. Now I want you to think about that because apparently he was enjoying, or somebody was enjoying, the Roman Hellenistic culture. Again, you point these things out from a geographical standpoint, historical standpoint. It was impact. Now, had they been before the captivity, had they been purely in the land that God gave them down here, let's go back. Go back. If they were over here in this land, Timothy and Paul and so forth, would they have been appealing to Rome? And just think about that. Things have changed so much by the time Jesus comes on the scene. It changed so much. Again, let's just look at Acts chapter 2. You're probably already there, but I think you might. Yes. That had not yet come. In fact, Dennis makes an excellent point. Who were the Romans mad at by the time AD 70 rolls around and they march into Jerusalem and destroy the temple? Who were the Romans mad at? The insurrection of the Jews. Masada, this is again right here. Herod the Great had built Masada. That was one of his retreat homes. It overlooked the Dead Sea, Salt Sea. It had pools and water up there on that high hill. And by the time AD 70 rolls around, the Jewish people were so mad. They couldn't get along with the Christians. They couldn't get along with the Romans. Think about it. They couldn't get along with each other. That's exactly right. And the Roman general Titus marches in, and Rome had enough. And it wasn't the Christians. Why did Jesus say in Matthew 24, Luke 21, Luke 19, Mark 13, Why did Jesus say, when you see these armies coming, do what? Get out. The Jews wouldn't hear that message. They didn't get out. And so you have chronicles and stories of the Jewish people, again, as has been mentioned, boiling their own babies and stuff because they were being starved out because they were besieged by the Romans. And history tells you it was not Christians. It was the Jewish people. So what Dennis says is absolutely true. The persecution against Christians didn't start to happen really in earnest till probably at the end of the first century, going into about 150 AD. So this was destroyed at Masada. The Jewish remnant had escaped and run up here, and they'd gone up on top of this hill. And the Romans built a parapet or some kind of a place to climb. What do you call that? It's basically a ramp. Yeah, a ramp. To get up there and to wipe them out. Because they had barricaded themselves up there on Masada. And so again, just again, what were the Christians doing during that time frame? We know. Preaching the gospel. Books of Revelation, Hebrews, 1st, 2nd Peter, various other books that were written later, Jude, they're preaching the gospel, writing these things and telling them to get with it. Okay, I don't have to get out of here. Let me see where I'm at here. So here's a picture of the book of Acts. We read Acts 1, verse 8 just a moment ago. When you think about Philippi, Philippians, the book of Philippians, what kind of a people were the Philippians? And I'll kind of end here, I guess. Paul writes to them and says what, basically? Thank you. Wonderful group of people. Does anybody know what Philippi, the city of Philippi, where it gets its name? It might have a connection. Philip of Macedon, someone say that? And who was Philip of Macedon the second? Alexander the Great's father. This city right here, Philippi, where those noble people were that helped Paul when no one else would. And Paul writes such wonderful things. That's where they were. They were in that city. A proud people. The Philippians were a proud people. Military town. Alexander the Great. Philip of Macedon the second. A great historical connection to the world. Again, a very well established. The gospel was preached again well here. Thessalonica up here. 1st, 2nd Thessalonica. What were the Thessalonians suffering with? What was their big issue? What were they worried about? Second coming of Christ. Someone tell them lies that they were going to not get to see their loved ones and so forth. And so on. Some of the Rome's over here. When you get to the end of the book of Acts, where does Paul end up? There's that long journey, that journey to Rome. How many times did they have problems in the Mediterranean Sea? I mean, Malta, this little island right here, snakes and stuff, vipers jumping out at them. Anyway, I've got to quit. This is the preaching of the gospel in a Bible geographical setting. I hope that we've enjoyed the class, and I have. So enjoy the rest of your summer.